We're looking at the broader implications of the antitrust lawsuits against Facebook and whether the social media giant will be broken up. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last week, the Federal Trade Commission in more than 40 states sued the social media giant, and they want the company to be split apart. So what regulations, if any, would you like imposed on Facebook and other tech firms? Are you hoping to see more antitrust lawsuits against the world's largest tech companies? We're at 800-642-1234. Lena Kahn is an associate professor at Columbia Law School, where she researches antitrust law and the anti-monopoly tradition. Lena, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
So antitrust laws are these statutes that governments come up with to protect us consumers from predatory business practices and to make sure there's competition, right? A more of an even playing field. Can you tell us what the lawsuits filed by the Federal Trade Commission and all of these states are alleging that Facebook is doing?
The lawsuits filed last week against Facebook are alleging that Facebook illegally maintained its monopoly, specifically through a campaign either to buy up its competitors or to bury them. So, you know, there are fair ways to compete, and then there are anti-competitive ways. And the states and the FTC are alleging that Facebook was engaging in these anti-competitive business practices.
And who are the players in this? I mean, who are Facebook's competitors? Who did they buy up? Who are they stifling?
Yeah, great question. So basically, the Facebook, when it entered the market back in, you know, 2004, 2005, there were a set of social networking players already on the scene, including companies like MySpace. And so Facebook was competing, you know, to try and draw users. It was really trying to make its services better. But once Facebook became more dominant, it started worrying that it would lose that dominance, especially once users started accessing social networking, not on desktop, but on their mobile phones. And that's when companies like Instagram, like WhatsApp, became more popular. And the complaints filed show emails internally where these executives were really scared. They were really frightened that they would be outcompeted. And so instead of trying to win out by actually making Facebook better, what did they do? They bought up Instagram and they bought up WhatsApp for billions of dollars. They actually paid $19 billion for WhatsApp at the time. So that was, you know, now is being determined that those were a series of illegal acquisitions. You can't, you know, you can compete by trying to make your products and services better. You can't compete just by trying to eliminate the competition by buying it up. So that's really the main main claim that's being alleged in these complaints. There was also a way in which Facebook cut off its competitors. So Facebook's network is used by, you know, thousands and thousands of other app developers so that they can hook onto Facebook's network and access more users. Facebook initially liked this because it was a way for Facebook to also get more users. But again, once it started identifying apps and developers that were threatening Facebook, it just cut them off. And again, there's a lot of evidence showing that Facebook basically weaponized its platform to target rivals and to go after them and make sure they couldn't survive.
Give us a sense how big Facebook is.
Facebook is the largest social networking site in the world. And not only does Facebook itself dominate, but it also owns several of the top other social networking services, be it Instagram or be it WhatsApp. So I think it owns three of the top six social networking services in the world.
And it made billions of dollars last year. The AP reporting more than $70 billion.
That's right. Yes, it made billions of dollars. Its valuation is upwards of $500 billion. It's one of the richest and most powerful companies in the world.
And there are other social media companies, you know, in this space, including, you know, Twitter, YouTube, Reddit, others. Why should we consider Facebook a monopoly?
So the FTC in the States note that Facebook is really unique. People go onto Facebook not to less to access content like they do with YouTube, but really to connect with each other and to share contact with each other. And so in that sense, you know, Facebook is dominant. It's not really competing with YouTube for the types of things that people actually go to Facebook for, right? You kind of go to Facebook to kind of check in what's going on with your family, which of your friends, you know, went on vacation, right? You weren't able to make that family wedding. You can sign on to see their photos. So it's really a different set of uses that people go to Facebook for than they do, you know, for Twitter. I go to Twitter to like check the news, to see, you know, analysis of various events. It's not to go see what's happening with, you know, actual friends and family in their personal lives. So these services are actually used for very different purposes. And the states and the FTC are alleging that in the market that Facebook dominates, it really is a uniquely powerful monopoly.
We're talking with Lina Khan. She's an associate professor at Columbia Law School, and she's explaining how the federal government and states are suing Facebook for allegedly breaking antitrust laws. You can join in with your questions. What do you think about the case against Facebook? Are you happy to see the government trying to rein in a tech giant, or is this too heavy-handed? 800-642-1234. Let's take a call now. Tom is with us from Burlington. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
What amazes me is all the information these people know about you. It's almost like we take it for granted. But I wanted to ask this question. Is when they broke up, historically, when they broke up AT&T, AT&T used to have a huge monopoly on telephones. And then these companies they had the five baby bells. They broke them up into five little baby bells. And then those baby bells became even bigger. And now it's back into the same situation it was before they broke it up. Mm. And I wonder, how can we prevent that from happening again, or is it going to work?
Yeah, Tom, bringing that historical context, Lena, what would you say?
That's a great question. I think there were a couple of things that happened there. One of which was that the government actually allowed those baby bells in some instances to actually merge, right? So when you're a big company and you want to merge or buy up another company, you have to report it to the federal government. And so the federal government, if they want, they can block it. And in that case, they didn't block it. And, you know, we've seen enormous consolidation within telecom over the last few years, the most significant merger of which was the Sprint T-Mobile deal, right? So that was, again, billions of dollars affecting Americans all across the country. So that was a deal that really took us from having four major giants to just three. And so for many Americans, you know, they're going to have fewer choices and their prices are already going up. So I think that's exactly right. And the way to stop it is to, you know, pressure our government to not allow these deals to go through in the first place.
Okay, so what remedies is the government seeking in this Facebook case?
So one of the main remedies they're seeking is for Facebook to divest Instagram and WhatsApp. So to spin those out as independent companies. So that really would look like the type of breakups that we've seen in the past with AT&T, with Standard Oil. That's one of the main remedies that these states and the FTC are requesting.
How realistic is it at this point to undo the acquisition of WhatsApp and Instagram?
I think it's quite possible that the judge will order that Facebook, you know, bought up these companies illegally. It made these acquisitions as part of a broader campaign to snuff out its rivals, that this is anti-competitive, that this really goes against what the antitrust laws are really for, and that the appropriate remedy there is that it should spin them off. I think that's quite possible. You know, these cases take a while, so this won't be litigated fully, you know, until the later half of next year. Even it may go into 2022. So I think it's going to take a while to play itself out, but it's very possible that you know, Facebook would have to spin these out as independent companies.
Lina Khan, the authority on antitrust and competition law. She's an associate professor at Columbia Law School. Do you use Facebook? What do you think of its services? Are you worried that the lawsuit could damage the company's services, or do you think it'll make them better? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're examining this wave of lawsuits in the pursuit of limiting the power of the world's tech giants. Facebook is being sued by the federal government and dozens of states, and we're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Has big tech, think Apple, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Facebook? Have they become too powerful? What should be the consequences for potential acquisitions and mergers? It's 800-642-1234. Lena Khan teaches antitrust law at Columbia Law School, and she's our guide. So, Lena, if Facebook would be broken up, what measures should or would be put in place to guarantee that competition is increased in the personal social networking marketplace in the U.S.?
I think if these services were broken off, I think we would actually start seeing them get better for users in a whole bunch of ways. The complaints note that, you know, since Facebook became a monopoly and was able to maintain this monopoly through just buying up its rivals, it actually has worsened its service for users in a whole bunch of ways, including through making privacy less secure for users. So we are all familiar now, you know, there have been years of revolutions about how Facebook has been really reckless with users' data. It's kind of, you know, been allowed malicious actors to get access to that user, to that data. It's actually gone back on its privacy promises. So WhatsApp in particular, before Facebook acquired it, used to be very secure, used to be very private, and people used to use WhatsApp precisely for that extra level of security. When Facebook bought up WhatsApp, you know, there were a lot of concerns, especially by privacy advocates, that this would be really bad. You know, Facebook's whole business model is to sell personal data about individuals for, to advertisers. And there was concern that WhatsApp would also become insecure. At the time, Facebook promised regulators that it wouldn't go back on any of the privacy commitments of WhatsApp. You know, this was really key to it being able to make this acquisition. Regulators approved it. What happened a few years later? Facebook undid all of those privacy commitments that WhatsApp had, making it less secure and making it less private for users. So I think, you know, if we had these spins, these breakups, you would have, at the very basic level, a greater number of individual executives and individual people making these decisions about these services. Right now, there's just so much decision-making power all consolidated effectively in Mark Zuckerberg, right? This one individual who controls these technologies that billions and billions of users are using around the world and that have really important consequences, right? I mean, there was evidence that there was election interference through Facebook, right? Facebook's decisions about how it structures its algorithm affects whether Americans are seeing particular types of information or whether that information is totally invisible to them, right? I mean, this is like a single individual, a single company making all of these decisions that are affecting Americans in really powerful ways. And so at the most basic level, breaking up Instagram and WhatsApp would just introduce more diversity. It would mean that if users are not liking the decisions that Facebook is making, they can go to Instagram, they can go to WhatsApp, that these services had the opportunity to actually compete. Some of the evidence that the states and the FTC collected are showing that even though Facebook has now bought up Instagram, it still feels threatened that Instagram will divert attention from Facebook. And so it's actually made decisions.
Even
that
if it's
Instagram,
under the same umbrella?
Even if it's under the same umbrella, that's right. It's what's so surprising. Facebook basically worries that Instagram will cannibalize traffic from Facebook. And so after buying them up, they actually suppressed Instagram on Facebook's own site. So I think there's, you know, a lot of opportunity for Instagram and WhatsApp to thrive as independent businesses and actually deliver better services for Americans.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Lena Khan, who is an associate professor at Columbia Law School and expert on antitrust law. We're discussing the litigation against Facebook and the efforts to seek to break it up, to break up the social media tech company. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Rebecca now, who's joining us from Onalaska. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, good morning. Great topic. I do agree with the breaking up of Facebook and their conglomerate, but my concern, even bigger, is Google. I work in an education system, and these kids have Google accounts from the time they're in kindergarten, and the amount of data that they're able to collect on these kids and keep until they're adults is astronomical, and unfortunately, school districts don't always necessarily have a choice on who they use as a network. So I'm just curious what they think about using Google and breaking up Google.
Rebecca, thank you for that question. Lena, what do you say there on, you know, in the face of Google here?
That's an excellent question. Rebecca is absolutely right. Google is also a monopoly, right? It dominates both online search as well as, you know, dozens of other services ranging from YouTube to email to, you know, digital advertising. It's now trying to become dominant in the home, right, with Nest and other devices. I think it's a big problem. And the House Antitrust Subcommittee last year investigated all of these tech companies, including Google, and concluded that Google is a monopoly and that it's abused its monopoly in a whole bunch of ways. And the Justice Department in October actually sued Google, alleging that it had also maintained and achieved its monopoly through a bunch of illegal tactics. So I think we are starting to see more regulatory attention on Google as well. The U.S. has actually kind of been an outlier. So countries around the world have already been bringing antitrust actions against Google. The European Commission brought 3 separate antitrust actions against Google, noting that it was a monopoly and it had abused its monopoly power. So the U.S. is now kind of catching up to that. But I think Rebecca is absolutely right. We need to be especially concerned about Google, especially given its inroads into, you know, education for kids and how all of these kids are, you know, having Google accounts from the get-go. And Google's business model, like Facebook's business model, is to sell targeted ads, right? So it's to sell to advertisers the ability to target every person, as you know, in the most personal way possible. And so that business model incentivizes both Google and Facebook to collect as much information as possible. And so I think it's really troubling that these services that Americans are relying on more and more, that, as Rebecca noted, oftentimes we don't actually have a choice, right? These kids don't have a choice. Yeah. That the business model there is to actually collect as much of their data as possible and you know, sell it. So I think that's a big problem.
Oh, well, while we're talking Google, what about other big tech firms? What about Apple? What about Amazon?
So Amazon and Apple are also both dominant. Amazon collects over 50%, captures over 50% of all online retail in the United States, in particular for particular products that share as high as 80%, as 90%. Its power has only grown through the pandemic as people have become more reliant on online retail. And, you know, for the merchants that rely on Amazon to access customers, Amazon has also used a series of anti-competitive tactics to maintain its dominance. And so that's something that the Congress has also looked at. They invited Jeff Bezos to come testify about a whole bunch of evidence. And he really didn't have good answers, which suggests that, you know, these tactics are happening. Similarly, Apple, you know, around half of all smartphone users are Apple users, and Apple has used that monopoly power in particular against developers who are trying to access iPhone users. So I think both of these firms are dominant, and they use several business practices that should be looked at more closely.
Well, let's fit in another call here. Matt is with us from Evansville. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Great topic today. Just was wondering about the right to be forgotten. It's a movement that's kind of taken off in Europe, and wondering, does the guest see that getting traction in the U.S. anytime soon? You know, people's decisions, what they post online, change over time, and can, you know, do we have a right to be forgotten? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, Matt, thank you. Lena, can you explain what this is?
That's a great question. And, you know, in Europe, we have had several countries adopt this idea of right to be forgotten. In the U.S., we haven't done anything like that, in part because, you know, our tradition around First Amendment and about having information out there about these topics is very strong. And we kind of look with fear upon government restrictions on the ability to express and publish and disseminate information. So I think the U.S. legal tradition is quite makes it quite at odds with this right to be forgotten idea. But I think, you know, it does get to this fundamental problem where do we want, especially for kids being raised in this era, do we want, you know, information about what happened to them as little kids to be out on the internet forever and ever? So I think it is a cultural and social debate that we need to be having.
We only have a few seconds left. What are you watching for in this litigation with Facebook?
Well, I'm watching to see first, you know, what types of arguments Facebook tries to offer in response. And then I'll be looking to see, you know, how the judge rules and whether he or she orders the company to be broken up.
Lena, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Lena Khan is an associate professor at Columbia Law School and an expert in antitrust law. Coming up, we talk with a scientist who is trying to use stem cells to grow human organs. That's after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about engineering lab-grown livers and what the future holds for synthetic biology. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. Scientists are growing these so-called human liver organoids in 17 days, and when implanted into mice with failing livers, these lab-grown replacement livers show promise. What do you want to know about stem cell research in lab-grown organs? If they'd be available in the future, would you receive a transplant with one? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. Mo Ibrahim-Khani is an associate professor of pathology and bioengineering at the Pittsburgh Liver Research Center and the McGowan Institute for Regenerative Medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Ibrahim-Khani, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you so much for your invitation.
Well, first, if you could help us with a bit of terminology, can you explain what an organoid is?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So basically, organoids are a group of cells that they are produced from stem cells, and they come together, they self-assemble together and generate in a three-dimensional format, generate a small tissue that reproduce some level of function or characteristic of the human organs. So it is similar to the native human organ. And in the size, it is a small. At the moment what you name it, organoid. But the cells are self-assembled together and they are produced from a stem cell.
And organoids are really what you're working on in your lab.
Yes, organoids and also tissues, basically, that are generated from stem cells are some of our main focus in the lab.
So what have you found in growing these organoid livers? What are you finding?
Right. So basically, you mean how we generate these tissues or how we apply them to a study?
Yeah, start with how you make them. How do you produce them? Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So these organoids or multi-cell type tissues that we generate in the lab, they are coming from induced pluripotent stem cells. These are stem cells that can produce any type of cells in our body. And we use them for a generation of liver here. How we go about this is that we actually focus on a new approach using genetic engineering to be able to engineer these cells to go through the different step of development using genetic switches. And by these genetic switches, we kind of navigate the cells toward our final target cells and tissues, which is liver here. So by basically using different genetic circuits, you can generate different cell types, and these cell types assemble together, and we have vasculature, we have hepatocyte building blocks in the liver, and some of the other cell types.
So why do you genetically engineer them? Do you have more control through genetic engineering than you would in traditional ways of working with these stem cells?
Well, that's a really important question. Yes, I think you exactly actually point to the right angle here. What we think it is important here is when we generate tissues, artificial tissues in the lab outside human body, we would like to have a control over when, how, and where to modulate the processes during the formation of the tissue. And even after implantation, you would like to have a control. For example, if a cell goes in the wrong direction, you have a control to kill or eliminate that cells, or even reroute it back to the right direction. Or if, for example, make it resistant against infectious disease. So for doing this, genetic engineering and genetic circuits would give us opportunity to basically incorporate these elements in our tissue with a design, basically generating tissues by design. And by doing that, you would be able to develop more control and navigate yourself at a time that you are interested in toward the final identities and final functions that you need to be done in an organ.
Could you then design an organ that is tailored directly to fit the type of organ you need for the person who is receiving that organ? Would those genetics come into play?
Sure. Partly they can play important role. And basically the iPS cells or induced pluripotent stem cells, one of the main angle and advantage of them is that they are produced from the cells that come in from the same individual. So their immunogenicity would be less than the cells that come from another individual. So that's an advantage. But apart from that, when you use genetic approaches, you can control that. You can design ways, for example, to target a specific elements that are important for activation immune system to make your product less immunogenic, less induce less stimulation. And this can be done at a different level, depending really the target design. You can start to think about how to come up with the best situation that decrease the immune response. And this is or would be appropriate for the patients or the individual of interest.
Yeah.
The thing here is it also depends on the application. So you depend on your application of interest. You can always tune this up and down.
Yeah, so you can really fine-tune here. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Mo Ibrahim-Khani. He's an associate professor of pathology and bioengineering at the University of Pittsburgh, and he's explaining his research in the lab growing these organs, these organoids, and the possibilities of what can be done with this stem cell research. You can join in with your questions about this. If lab-grown organs are available in the future, would you accept them? What do you think are the most exciting possibilities that stem cell research has to offer? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Ibrahim-Khani, scientists are able to grow human cells and tissues, as you've said, in the lab using stem cells. But those tissues, often they have problems that keep them from being used in pharmaceutical studies or as transplant organs. What are the big obstacles? Why is that?
Well, there are a lot of promises and a lot of basically progress were made during the past years. But also, obviously, there are always with new technologies and new advances comes with some new challenges. One of the main challenges here in the context of, for example, using the tissues for drug discovery is that sometimes the tissues that are generated from a stem cells are not mature enough. They are at the fetal stages, like a tissue that's coming from a fetus. It is not like a tissue that's coming from an adult human organ. And this challenge actually was one of the important motivation of our studies in the lab to use genetic engineering for further mature the tissue. And that was one of the actually core parts of our studies, that we could further improve the maturation of the tissue. Still, we don't get a fully mature tissue, but we could improve that. We should provide a proof of principle that it is possible by using genetic engineering, you mature the tissue. So I think maturation is one of the main challenges that we are working on to make sure that we generate a tissue that is quite similar to the final adult human liver or other organs.
And when you're talking about fully mature tissue and regenerative tissue, you know, organs, of course, need a blood supply to stay alive. Yeah. Do these lab-grown organs have blood vessels, and are they also grown from stem cells?
Right, right. So that's exactly one of the other angles. When we use genetic engineering, we could actually generate multiple cell types, including the vessels at the same time. And these cells and structure assembled together. So the tissue that we generated were vascularized. And that is another actually angle that is important in the field of organoids, that for being able to make the tissue to perfuse, get nutrients and oxygen after the implantation, you need to have those vascular structures there. And we could actually get those vascular structures using this approach. And so this is basically the second challenge. One was maturation. Second is the vascularization, that they go hand in hand.
Yeah.
Kind of generation of the pure tissue, that you don't have any aberrant unwanted cell type. That is another challenge, to make sure that you have a fully clean tissue. And we could also get some improvement in that area when we use our approach. What I should mention about our approach is that we did genetic engineering, but we collaborated with a scientist at Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Patrick Kahan, and also scientists at University of Pittsburgh, genetic engineer Dr. Samira Kiani. So we had a team to tackle this. For Dr. Patrick Kahan, we basically collaborated to do the computational analysis of the tissue and compare it with adult organs and make sure that understand what is missing there when we compare a synthetic tissue with a native human liver. And then we identified potential targets that we should go after for genetic engineering. So in this way, we kind of make it a very, to some extent, unbiased approach.
Yeah. So a lot of computation going on there, a lot of collaboration. We're talking with Dr. Mo Ibrahim-Kani, telling us about his research. It's published in the journal Cell Systems this month, and the promise of speeding up the growth of lab-grown organs, making them viable. What do you want to know about machine learning to reverse engineer genes to grow human organs? Are designer organoids, as we've been talking about, the future of medicine? Still time to hear from you, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Dr. Ibrahim-Kani right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with University of Pittsburgh pathologist Mo Ibrahim-Kani about the potential for growing human liver organoids in the lab, replete with blood and bile handling systems. They've found that using genetic engineering, it's possible to reverse engineer a liver so that it functions like your normal adult human liver. Let's take a call on this. Bill is joining us from Wakefield, Michigan. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Thank you for what you do, and what a great topic. I have a friend now named Paulina that explained to me a couple of years ago about what she was doing in the process with liver growing with Dr. Atala at Wake Forest. I wonder if he was aware of him.
Oh, you mean the work going on at Wake Forest University in growing? Are they growing livers there? Do you know, Bill?
Well, yeah, he's in the process of that for children.
What is collaboration like, Dr. Ibrahim Khani, on this effort?
Yeah, I know about, I have heard about some of the efforts going at Wake Forest University, and I think several groups at different areas in U.S. and outside the U.S. Doing great work on the context of the organ engineering at different sizes. Some focus on a smaller scale organ engineering and some in a larger size organ engineering. There are obviously many different challenges in the at different scales. For example, size of the tissue, non-scaling up of the tissue, the quality of the tissue, vasculature, scaffold. So many scientists from different disciplines trying to address these different areas. And collaboration, obviously, is going on quite a bit depending on the project.
Dr. Ibrahim Khani, tell us about what happened with the mice, these mice that had liver disease, and you transplanted these lab-grown organs, these livers. What happened?
Right. So I would say that these tissues that we generate have a small size. So they are like, that's why we said, also we would say organoids. They are not like a big, like a chunk of liver. So we implant many of them together in a scaffold inside the abdomen, inside the body, and then abdominal cavity, and then we monitor the mice after the liver disease, and we observe that actually the life expectancy and the survival of the mice improved, and that was quite promising for us. Obviously, we need to work further toward efficacy to make sure that these tissues are more effective and they can be more protective in the context of liver disease. And that's the target of our future studies.
Yeah, so very promising start. Let's bring in Ron now in Cameron with a question. Hi, Ron.
Hi, good morning. I think the doctor maybe just answered my question. I'm a biotech teacher, and a couple of years ago, our students and we read an article about, I think, this process and what scaffolding was, and I think it involved some type of animal stem cell, like sheep at that time. And I'm just wondering, are they human stem cells? Could you explain the scaffolding process just briefly in layman's terms? I'll take my answer off the air. I got to go to school. Bye.
Oh, bye. Thank you so much, and thanks for teaching. Go ahead, doctor.
Sure. Thank you for the question. So the approach that we use actually is a scaffold free. So we didn't use any scaffold. We let the cells to come together, assemble together, and self-organize. So that is actually one of the features that sometimes used in the context of the organoids. But there are other approaches that use a scaffold and then trying to fill the scaffold by cells that you produce separately, and they're trying to shape the cells and control how the cells organize together. So there's two different, basically, approach that exists out there. And what we did in this study, we didn't use any scaffold, so the scaffold free and the cells were self-organized.
Okay, so because you could kind of mold those cells through the scaffolding approach, but you kind of let them freeform and let the cells do what they please in
exactly.
a way.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes, we wanted to actually exploit the self-organization capacity of the cells so they can talk to each other freely, communicate with each other, and make decisions. And we thought that if we put too much control on that angle, we may not get explore that type of self-organization in the best possible way to get the vasculature and the structure that we were interested in.
The second piece, the second piece of Ron's question about where these stem cells come from, where the source is.
Human. That's a human stem cell.
Gotcha. Okay, so let's bring in Charlotte now in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi. How are you doing this morning? I was just saying that two things. Well, one was, are they able to make kidneys? And then another thing was, when my husband had cancer and they removed his ear, they asked if they could have I don't know exactly what they were asking for, but something with his cells so they could study. And it's funny that I asked them, I was jokingly asking the tech, oh, are you going to make a human? And she answered very seriously. She said, I don't know.
Charlotte, thank you for those questions. First off, what about kidneys, Dr. Ibrahim Khani?
Sure. So thanks for the questions. There are efforts that are going on in generation of kidney organoids. Several studies, both in U.S. And also in outside U.S. in Europe and Australia, there are studies that focus solely on generation of the kidney organoids and kidney tissues using different approaches. So it is ongoing and also very promising.
So how far along are your livers versus what they're doing in growing kidneys and in the kidney development?
I think I would say in the context of using genetic engineering for programming tissues, this study was one of the very first ones to show that it is possible. I'm not aware of studies in kidney that have shown genetic approaches for programming and multicellular tissue similar to kidney.
Okay.
But obviously, other approaches were used for generation of kidney, and they are promising. Obviously, it would be of interest in future to see whether what we did for liver can be applicable to kidney or other type of organs.
We only have a short time left, but what is the next step toward achieving, you know, human livers in the lab? Where do you go next?
Yes, I think... obviously, one obvious part is a scale-up, right? So you for mouse, you mean a small piece of tissue. For human, you need much larger size of the tissue for implantation or transplantation. So that is one of the main angles for future, scaling up. Another part that I think would be very important and would be a focus of future years would be making sure about safety of the tissue, making sure that we have a full control over formation of the tissue and also monitoring of the tissue after implantation. So these are, I think, areas that would be important part of the studies for future, in addition to the fact that you can always make your tissue better and better to make it more effective.
Are you going to stay with using mice, or would you move on to something else?
We still have a little bit more work to do with mouse studies to make sure we can improve some of these angles. And obviously, after finding answers to those questions at this level, then we're going to move to the larger animals.
Okay, moving to the larger animals after mice. Dr. Ibrahim Khani, thank you for joining us and explaining your research.
Of course. It was my pleasure.
Dr. Mo Ibrahim Khani is an associate professor of pathology and bioengineering at the Pittsburgh Liver Research Center and the McGowan Institute for Regenerative Medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. We have a link to the study in the journal Cell Systems. It's at wpr.org/mornings. Just ahead, the host of Emily's Wonder Lab on Netflix, Emily Calandrelli, is here, brings us some wacky science experiments to do at home. Watch out, grown-ups. The volcanoes are erupting in T-minus 7 minutes. Seriously, this is going to be fun. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.